While herbalism can lend itself to encyclopedic lists of herbs and their actions, it's also rich in heritage and the stories of people. This from Holly Belabono, author of Women Healers of the World, a very beautiful coffee table worthy book that also belongs in your library. It's got me excited to have a very herbally infused winter. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Holly, welcome.
Hi, thanks to be here.
Your book, Women Healers of the World, resonates with Tributaries in that I find my interviewees' stories as important and interesting as their topics. Why did you want to highlight these women and create this book?
Well, I've been an herbalist for a long time, about 20 years, and have long focused on the plants, my connection with the plants, and helping other people establish a relationship with the plants and the natural world. And the longer I was an herbalist, the more I realized how much women contribute to the heritage and this knowledge that I was being gifted. There are many, many healers and people contributing, men and women, but I felt like men were credited more often, more frequently than women in science, botany, medicine, research. And I really was becoming more and more aware of women being contributors, and I wanted to give them credit. I wanted to acknowledge that that heritage and that tradition of a feminine voice in science. And so I started seeking out women of the past and also women in the present who are actively involved in their communities, working with plants, healing people, sharing knowledge, doing research, building cooperatives and communities. And I felt really happy to finally be able to feature 31 women from 20 countries in my book.
And throughout the ages, I might add.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, going back to about 1421 BC in Egypt with Pharaoh Hatshepsut. She's
and
the earliest.
How did you get that interview?
She was pretty fascinating to research. She was a king. You know, she led her country as a king and ruled for about 21 years, I think. And she was in charge of her royal navy and ended up sending her navy on an expedition to the land of Punt, which we think today is Somalia. And her navy was gone on this expedition for 3 years, and when they came back, they arrived with incredible treasures, some of which hadn't been seen before, gold and silver and animals, leopards, ostriches, but also plants. And a couple of those plants that were very meaningful to her and her culture were myrrh, like the myrrh gum resin that we use as an incense, and also lettuce. And I think the reason that lettuce was important to her, today we use lettuce as a vegetable, it's a salad, but we also use it, herbalists use it as a sedative, a very mild sedative and relaxer. They, I think, it was a fertility symbol to them, because when you break open a lettuce stalk fresh from the ground, it oozes white latex, and that white liquid to them was symbolic of breast milk or semen. And so it was a fertility herb, and that kind of shows you how people started looking at plants long, long ago, how the plants have been in our psyche longer than we know.
Well, I love your answer just then brought in, I think, all of the rest of my questions at once. You mentioned early on in your book the two qualities of all these women that they shared, and the one regarding confidence surprised you. How so?
Well, I went in thinking that all these women would have plants in common. You know, that was the thread that tied them all together, and they did. But they also shared a couple of other characteristics that that I wasn't really expecting. That was a big learning experience for me. And one of them was confidence. As you say, these women were, they're all very confident. They're all very self-assured, poised women who are doing what they love. But even more than that, some of the more indigenous healers that I spoke with, such as Doña Enriqueta Contreras. She's a midwife from Mexico, and a couple of the Polynesian healers that I spoke with in Hawaii. They shared a philosophy with me of self-confidence that kind of goes beyond what we think of as self-confidence. It was more of a conviction and a complete innate trust in God or the universe or spirit that gave them the gift to be a healer. They told me, you know, if you don't feel confident that you're a healer, you need to get out of the camp, that you can't think that an herb that you give someone is going to help, or if you're a doctor, you can't think that the medication you're prescribing is going to help. You have to absolutely know 100%. And it was that sort of confidence that really struck me, because I don't think we focus that much on that sort of integrity in our careers. We work toward it, probably, but we don't insist on it. And this was an indigenous philosophy that I found. They absolutely insist on it.
Well, it would seem to me that within that insistence would be a knowledge of, beyond a belief of, a higher power. And that might be an assumption, but I would seem, in order to have supreme confidence, there would have to be something more than the plant or the healer.
I'm sure that comes into it, that the spirituality is a very intense, personal, deeply ingrained spirituality that they feel. And I kind of got the sense that it was, you know, if you're given these gifts of being able to use your intuition or use the knowledge that's shared with you about the plants or the chemistry or their actions, that's one thing, that you're given this gift, but then it's a completely other thing to use that gift. You know, it's one thing to have it and know that you're talented in something, and it's a completely other thing to make a career out of it and actually save other people's lives. In fact, one of them said to me, you know, we're not carpenters, we're not building houses or tables, you know, that's not our career. Our career is saving lives. And when you're working with someone's health and it's a matter of life and death, you really need to understand what you're doing. And that's a special gift, I think.
Yes, yes, well said. Was your experience or definition of what healing actually is expanded and changed after speaking with all of these women? I mean, is it solely saving a life, a physical life? Is it creating peace?
You know, it's such an interesting concept to me. What is healing? What is the mechanism of healing? It has been a really big eye-opener for me to complete this project. I've been working on this book for 7 years. And throughout that journey to talk with different people and find out, what is healing? You know, is a doctor, is that your healer? Or is healing innate? Does it come from within? Does healing come from the plants in the natural world? Is it more of a chemical thing? Is it a combination? Is it spiritual? Does it come from God? You know, where healing comes from is such a deep question, and I think culturally the women that I spoke with approached it from very different perspectives, and it just opened my eyes to the diversity of thought regarding healing and your own powers, for lack of a better word, to heal yourself. Because my personal opinion is it's a combination of all those. It comes from within, it comes from without. You have to cultivate it. You can't expect it to be handed to you, but you also can't expect to be born with the ability to heal. It's something you have to work on. It's such a fascinating topic to me, and talking with these women really opened my eyes in a lot of directions to that.
I know many healers and shaman come into their path after being wounded. I guess many of us have heard the wounded healer terms. Did you find this to be true with herbalists and plant healers? In reading your book, it sounded like a lot of them came to it through mentoring.
Well, maybe those two things are a little bit different, at least in my mind, whether they were wounded and came in to be a healer from there, or whether they were mentored. You know, now that you mention it, were actually wounded before they entered the path of being a healer, and maybe that was a big instigator for them. For instance, Bernadette Rabineau is a healer in Gabon. She's a shaman in Gabon, Africa, and she actually suffered an illness when she was about 5 years old that blinded her temporarily, and she was taken to a pygmy doctor by her family for healing, and the doctor is the one who, I guess, prophesied that she would eventually be a healer herself, and she did indeed go down that road after she got better. Also, Doña Enriqueta Contreras in Mexico, she's a midwife, and she, I suppose, you know, you could use the word wounded. She was abandoned as a child and lived in a goat pasture, a remote goat pasture, far from people, lived with goats for 2 years, and suffered a great deal during that time, but also learned a lot from living among these animals, especially about birth. And it really impressed upon her the values and the perspectives and the methods of childbirth, so that she became a midwife and was an incredibly successful midwife for the next 60 years. She's still alive. She's in her 70s, but that's an interesting point you make, because both of those women were wounded early on, but it certainly led to their incredible careers as healers. And then mentoring. I kind of think of mentoring maybe a little bit different. I think of mentoring as someone kindly taking you under your wing and helping you, which is what a lot of these women did experience. They were brought up by mothers and grandmothers and aunts or brothers who willingly shared their knowledge with them, and it was a very organic experience for them to become healers since they were mentored in that capacity, which is a wonderful thing, and I really try to pass that along to the young women who come and study with me. I really try to mentor them and help them as best I can, because it's such a valuable tradition. Sharing that knowledge, there's just nothing like it.
Yes, I keep going into all the roots of plants and how important it is to share this information. And if we just hold on to it, it doesn't do very much good.
Yeah, you got to get it out there. You got to share it. Pass it on.
Yes.
Very important.
Of course, every plant is unique, but plants also differ around the world for obvious reasons, but I believe also possess similar properties. Do they all become universal in use, or did you find anyone using a plant that you would consider truly unique in the world?
I actually found a lot of commonality. I found that a lot of women in different countries, from Mexico to Scotland to Tibet, were using some of the same plants in the same ways. For instance, Phusong Wangmo in Tibet is a woman I spoke with, and she lives here in North America now, but one of her favorite herbs in Tibet was Angelica. She loved it and was thrilled to find it here, and uses it for some of the same purposes that herbalists in Western traditions do. Other herbs are really they're the weeds. They grow everywhere. They're what we call weeds, but part of their success is their tenacity, and that they do grow everywhere. And people around the world have learned to use them pretty much for the same things, such as plantain, St. John's wort, mint. Herba buena is mint in Peru, and one of the women I interviewed was Mama Kia. She ran an orphanage outside of Cuzco, Peru. And one of the herbs that she taught her children how to cook with and how to make medicines with was mint, or herba buena. And that is used worldwide for many of the same purposes, you know, indigestion, circulatory stimulant. So I thought that was fascinating, that a plant can make itself known in that way all over the world.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating that that's so true. Do you think that plants named invasive species present a problem or an opportunity to look at a plant anew? There are so many regulations in places where you can't bring a seed or anything in, and of course we don't want to bring any pesticides or anything like that, but people on islands and elsewhere kind of freak out about a new plant coming in to take over, but it seems like there must be some kind of reason.
Yeah, you know, that's a touchy subject. It has become more of a touchy subject lately because there's such a dialogue about what are invasive species and what are they going to knock out of the ecosystem. Here in Massachusetts, autumn olive, Eleagnus genus, is considered an invasive species, and it's against the law to plant it, but it's an incredible food plant. It produces berries that are very high in lycopene, and you can eat. Another herb here on the island, I live on Martha's Vineyard, so it's an island environment, and we're experiencing a surge in Japanese knotweed. It's everywhere, and people are saying it's an invasive, but it's interesting to me because it's an herb that's used by herbalists such as Stephen Buhner to counteract Lyme disease, and Lyme is epidemic here.
Yes, it's rampant.
So I think it's so fascinating, you know, there's a problem that arises, such as Lyme, and then these herbs come in to address that problem, and we haven't quite recognized that that connection yet with a lot of plants.
I know, it just starts this inner giggle in me that things are so sweetly packaged like that.
Yeah, there's a lot out there that we don't understand yet, and it's so fascinating to me, like maybe these plants are, like you said, they're kind of laughing. Like, one day they'll figure it out.
You pose a question in your book, conservation or collection?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feature some women who are gardeners in the book, and there's just always that question of, are people who collect, like the early botanists who went around gathering samples of different species, are they doing humanity a favor? Is that sort of collection, is it conservation or is it exploitation? It's a minor question in the book. It's not something I really propose an answer for, but it is interesting to think about how we go about training up the next generation of plant lovers and scientists and herbalists. I personally prefer to focus on the garden and cultivation and growth. Although I do a lot of wildcrafting too. I harvest wild plants, and I really teach people how to identify plants in the wild and harvest them ethically. There's a lot of respect that has to go into it so that we maintain the balance of the diversity in the ecosystem that we need.
What are some main points you teach about collecting ethically?
Well, one of the major ones is, if you go through an area and you harvest herbs from that particular spot, you want to be able to turn around and look back at it and not ever think that you had been there. You know, if the way people did it in the past with ginseng, for instance, people would go through and rip out every ginseng plant they could see, and if they turned around, they would look back in the woodlands and there wouldn't be any ginseng left. Really, the more appropriate way to do it is to harvest approximately one out of every 10 plants. And that way you know that you're leaving seed stock and root stock for the coming years, and you're not over-harvesting or threatening a population. There's an organization called United Plant Savers that is doing a really good job of teaching people these wildcrafting methods and the ethics involved in being an herbalist and working with medicinal plants. Talking about the conservation of wild plants and herbs, and when is it appropriate to use them because it's part of our heritage and we need to, and when is it appropriate to not use them and maybe skip a season or skip that herb altogether and let it regenerate in the wild before we make it part of our medicine again.
Holly, you're not featured in your book, but I know, as you've mentioned as well in the interview here, that you do teach. What do you consider the oldest form of pharmacology and formulary?
The oldest form? I suppose just eating, using plants as food. Hippocrates famously said, you know, let your medicine be your food and your food be your medicine, or maybe it was the other way around, but the point was that, you know, getting these plants into your diet is the best way to keep yourself, give yourself the nutrition that you need, as well as the pharmacology and the formulary that you need. And then after that, you know, if you're talking real formulary and pharmacology, there are some very ancient traditions. There's traditional Chinese medicine, there's ancient Tibetan medicine, there's Ayurveda out of India, incredibly old systems of medicine that have been around for thousands of years that are really interesting to learn about. Some of them use polypharmacy, which is combining multiple different herbs together, in some cases even up to 60 or 70 different herbs in a formula. Others, such as the Western herbal tradition that grew out of Europe, they use more simples, which is focusing on one plant at a time to really get a feel for what it does in your body. Mm. I like using simples, and I like using formulas that use somewhere between 3 and 8 or 9 or 10 herbs. I think a rough handful like that is a nice blend. You can get some good synergy when you're making formulas with that number of herbs and really get to know what the herb is doing in your body.
Did you find, or did any of the women you spoke with find, that they had a certain remedy that worked best when they were actually using it?
I don't know. A lot of the women I spoke with definitely had favorite plants and returned again and again to those plants that worked very well for them and for their clients. Elderberry was a favorite herb, St. John's wort, sage, oregano, plantain. Some of the, you know, these were among the ones that were mentioned over and over again. And, if, you know, the two main ways that the herbalists tend to use the plants, and it differed widely. I mean, we're talking about cultures from Europe to Africa to South America, so there's a wide range of how they use them. But one of the more common ways that people use the herbs is as a tea, or an infusion is really the better term.
Yes.
Which is a water extract of the plant. So it's hydrating, it gives your body the fluid that it needs, and it extracts these chemical properties from the plant in a very safe manner. And it's enjoyable. Everybody loves to sip on a really tasty cup of tea. So that tends to be one of the most favorite ways to take your herbal medicine.
I did a workshop years ago with Dr. Christopher, and his favorite herb was lobelia, and he just had some really funny stories of people that had not OD'd in the they died sense, but, you know, just speaking to the potency of what that herb would do.
Yeah, well, it's called pukeweed for a reason.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's an interesting herb. Susan Weed is an herbalist in New York. I took a workshop with her ages ago, and she let people try what she called a flying formula. It had lobelia in it, lobelia inflata, and it was a very interesting feeling to get after that. You know, it takes only a tiny amount, because too much can really give you a feeling of nausea, but just the right amount was a very intriguing experience. She gave us two samples. One was what she called a flying formula, and one was what she called a love potion, and there were different herbs involved. There was roses and the lobelia and chicory and a number of other different herbs. I left her workshop feeling like I was walking on clouds. It was a wonderful feeling. I felt light and happy, and would love to recreate that experience and figure out what, you know, exactly which herbs were working and how she created those, because it was very fun and very affirming. So it was an exciting eye-opener to the world of plants.
Do you think, or did you find other women healers find it necessary to bring the plant into the scientific laboratory?
Some of the women do, absolutely. Tiarona Lodog is a physician in Arizona, I believe. She is very much a modern allopathic physician, but she approaches it from a very integrative point of view. She studied with Native American cultures early on. She's a midwife, and she's a physician, so she approaches it from a very integrated perspective of the spirituality of plants and the chemistry of plants. Another woman I spoke with, Jody Noe, is a naturopathic physician in Pennsylvania, and she's a Cherokee practitioner, very strongly practicing in the realm of Cherokee medicine and traditional Native healing arts, but she's a naturopathic physician and is very in tune with the allopathic pharmacology of plants and has written books on cancer treatment using plants from their chemical perspective.
It's interesting working with people, and we're going back again now into that healing, the healer.
Right. It's, what is the mechanism of healing?
Yeah, it's a fine line, too. People, it seems, these days, perhaps more than the older days when everyone was used to, well, if I don't go milk my cow, I'm not going to have milk. And, of course, that has spilled over into medicine, where people come and say, save me. I don't want to do what I need to, but do it for me and make me well.
Yeah, they hand over that power to someone else, most often a doctor, and then they let go and they say, it's going to happen to me. Someone needs to save me, which is a shame. It's a loss of personal autonomy. It's a loss of personal integrity. I think everyone has that ability, not only ability, but really duty to tap into their own healing. Now, being a consultant, I don't consider myself a healer. I consider myself more of a facilitator. It feels better to me. You know, I work with people, and they are co-creators in their healing experience. I don't think of myself as the healer, the hero, you know, the doctor. Definitely more of a facilitator, because it's sharing of a knowledge, and it's sharing experience, and it's introductions to these plants and what they do, and then the person in question has to take all that information and apply it themselves. And the women in the book, it was definitely a little of that and a little God coming in, a very spiritual approach.
Well, I love you divided the book into four parts: plant, body, spirit, land, tradition.
Those divisions are kind of fluid. All of these women are of the land. They're all of the spirit. I think all of us embody parts of each in whatever careers we have. You know, I like the categories, and I think it moves very well, but I don't want to pigeonhole anybody. Hopefully it'll be a nice starting point, kind of a sounding board for people who pick up the book to explore a particular realm or tradition and then feel comfortable moving on to the next.
And I love that you put in there a little vignette about the origins of the word vegetation. Where did it turn into vegging out and becoming a couch potato?
Yeah, it's a shame, isn't it?
Yes.
It used to be such a word of vitality and energy. I love the etymology, and I had a lot of fun including the etymology of all these different words from healing traditions, because the words are how we have gotten the traditions. All of these healing arts, they're oral traditions, and I thought that the words were very important. The whole linguistic history was something that really needed to be shared. So there's words about birth and tincture, innovation. All these different words are explained in the book of how they originated and then how they influenced modern medicine. For instance, the word apothecary, that's one of my favorites. It had a long history, and it began way back when with Proto-Indo-European languages as apotheca, or to put away, and it was where people would put away their important things like food and medicine and wine, you know, the things that they survived on. They would put it away somewhere safe, and it became apothecary. And in modern day, it actually has three descendants. We have bodega, boutique, and apothecary that all come from that same word.
Holly Belobano, author of Women Healers of the World. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. For podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.